This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is hosting Here and Now today. Americans mythologize the frontier, the cowboy, the yeoman farmer, taming the soil and the wilderness. But the reality today is that the United States is a mostly urban culture. More than 80% of Americans live in cities or metropolitan regions. So arguably, the real America is downtown America. Our guest today says, as Washington squabbles over yet another debt limit showdown, wallowing in partisan gridlock, cities are moving on with business. It is cities, not the federal government, that are the engines of economic prosperity and social transformation. And joining me to talk about this is Jennifer Bradley. She's the co-author with Bruce Katz of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. She joins us now from another major metropolitan area, Washington, D.C., in the Brookings Institution, where she's a fellow. And Jennifer Bradley, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's a great topic. And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you see cities, Boston in particular, or maybe your town in the Boston metro area, as laboratories for democracy, for public policy, for social progress? What is this city, your city, doing right or wrong to advance these interests? Or is Washington where things really are, where things are really getting done? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Jennifer Bradley, here we are in the midst of a mayor's race in Boston. So it's a great time to be having this conversation with you. And your argument is that around the nation, when it comes to solving these big problems, the action is here at the local level. And I want to talk about Boston in particular, but explain your thesis that mayors and cities are becoming the nation's best problem solvers rather than Washington. What's going on?
Well, as my co-author Bruce Katz and I were doing research for our book, The Metropolitan Revolution, we looked around and we saw that cities and metros were facing enormous challenges after the recession. They were having to create jobs. They were having to deal with this big increase we've seen in the nation in the poor and near poor population. And they were finding that Washington was not a reliable partner. Washington was tangled up in its own gridlock and kind of internal debates, and they weren't reaching out to cities and metropolitan areas and saying, how can we help? So cities and metros said, it's on us. It is our responsibility to invest in infrastructure and create ballot measures and other ways of creatively financing infrastructure. It's on us to make manufacturing a priority again, to try and be a create jobs that are a better ladder into the middle class. It's our job even to reach out to other metropolitan areas across the globe and find new markets for our products and ideas in our places. It's our job to equip workers with the kind of skills they're going to need in the global economy. Metropolitan areas are increasingly stepping up. It's not just mayors who are acting. It's mayors in conjunction with university presidents, philanthropic leaders, community groups, business leaders, labor leaders, and they're all coming together and saying, we're on our own. So what can we do together as a network to make our place more competitive and a better place for our citizens?
So how is that manifested, this idea that you're talking about? How is it manifested in a city specifically like Boston? I know, for example, in your book, you write about innovation districts, for example, mm-hmm. Kendall Square in Cambridge, the plans to develop the South Boston waterfront, this kind of thing.
Innovation districts take what's best about cities, which is their ability to concentrate people and create the opportunity for the kind of unplanned interactions that lead to new ideas and new companies, and really takes advantage of it. It focuses on putting new companies along with places like business incubators and finance supports, all in a pretty confined space so that one entrepreneur can always talk to another entrepreneur and say, hey, you know, how did you solve this particular problem around financing? Somebody who's working on a small business plan in one area can talk to somebody about technical expertise and say, you know, I've got this idea. I think I know how to manufacture it, but I need somebody to help me with a prototype. Who can help me with a prototype? There's somebody down the hall or across the street who can help them with that. That's the benefit. Innovation districts kind of concentrate the best parts of cityness into one building or one zone or a defined stretch. And it it facilitates these kinds of interactions that lead to new jobs, new companies. Universities are often an important ingredient in innovation districts. That's why, Kendall Square is such a hotbed. But you don't have to have a university at the core of your innovation district. Again, on the South Waterfront, you just need to get the right number of people and supports kind of interacting together and understanding that they're in a place where they're supposed to interact, they're supposed to connect, and they've got access to all of these other public and nonprofit services that can help entrepreneurs realize their dreams.
So is this, this embrace of innovation districts in and around Boston, is this part of that metropolitan revolution? And in that sense, is it sort of radiating out from Boston and sort of influencing policy makers in the rest of the country in a way that Washington should but can't?
I think that the ideas behind innovation districts, like a lot of the great ideas that are animating metropolitan area leaders, are getting picked up and distributed. So there's an innovation district in Boston. There's also one in Barcelona, Spain, Detroit. Even Detroit is developing an innovation district along its midtown-downtown corridor. We see innovation districts, maybe they're not called innovation districts. Maybe they're called University Mile, or maybe they're called the healthcare district, or maybe they're called something else, springing up across the country as people realize, hey, we have a lot of these assets, and we need to do a better job of connecting the people who are inventing things in our laboratories with people who know how to make things, with people who know how to build companies, and with people who know how to finance companies. Metropolitan areas and cities are able to move forward because they can learn from each other so quickly. They can take an idea, they can adjust it for local circumstances, and they can replicate it. And we do think that that's the key element of the metropolitan revolution, is that cities aren't waiting for instructions from the state capital or from Washington. They're learning from each other. They're sussing out the best ideas, and they're saying, you know what, we can make that happen. We're as smart as as the guys in the next state or the next region over, and we can build on these things and create benefits for our communities.
Mm. Listeners, we're talking to Jennifer Bradley. She's the co-author, along with Bruce Katz, of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. Boston has a bit of an appearance in this, specifically around this issue of innovation districts. We want to ask you to join the conversation. Do you see cities, whether it's Boston or wherever you live, in particular as laboratories for democracy, for public policy, for social progress? What is this city, your city, doing right to advance these kinds of interests? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Jennifer Bradley, you write that the feds have sort of failed because of all kinds of dysfunction in Washington, and that cities have stepped up. When did the feds set the agenda? Did they ever? How was it different?
I think if you look at the history of federalism in this country, you see it's kind of it's like a wave, right? It peaks at some points at the federal government, and then it sort of flows back into a more local orientation. I think we had a real peak after the Great Depression, right, when Washington really did have to reach out and help reshape the economy of the nation to keep us out of catastrophe. Then over the next several decades, you saw more and more power kind of coming up to Washington, the 60s, the 70s. There was a turning point in the Reagan era when President Reagan said, why don't we recover some of the elements of federalism? And he started to push stuff back down to the states. What's new about the metropolitan revolution, though, is that people are understanding you've actually got to – things go really well if you devolve power even further down – and you appreciate the power, the fact that metropolitan areas are economic engines. Just the top 100 metropolitan areas in the country, not all of them, just the top 100, they sit on about one-eighth of our land mass, but they concentrate about two-thirds of the population, and they're responsible for three-quarters of the American economy. On all of the things that matter for economic power, innovation, science and technology workers, infrastructure, they punch way above their weight. They've got a 75, 80, 85, 90% share of these important economic assets. And so I think we're realizing that federalism and the way we devolve power and who we look to lead on particular issues needs to take into account the metropolitan economic power and metropolitan policy creativity, particularly in a period in which Washington is stuck and in which Washington's ability to respond to problems is going to be sharply limited by the obligations that Washington has on mandatory spending. That's going to crowd out a lot of other spending. So really, again, metropolitan areas and to a certain extent states are on their own to solve problems. Mm.
And can they solve big problems in a big way? Or are we talking about sort of small bore answers to big problems that, you know, that we really need a sort of federal response to?
I think that you need city and metropolitan areas kind of to set the agenda and federal resources often to come in behind them. So we see across the country, for example, in Portland. Portland, Oregon is an incredibly export-intensive economy, and they want to increase their exports because they know that the more you can sell abroad, the more jobs you have in your own community. So they're reaching out and selling this idea of we build green cities and going around the world and saying, if you need help with rapid urbanization that's going to be sustainable, we know how to do that. We have the technical skills. We have the consulting skills. Come to Portland and find out what you need. To back that up, the United States' role, of course, is open markets, trade mission, trade support, and a certain amount of financing. There's a balance to be made, right? The United States needs to create a good safety net. It's very hard for local governments to address the needs of the poor population and redistribute income because people will just move – people with resources will just move themselves just outside the area that the government is trying to tax. So the federal government needs to set a level playing field and help the most vulnerable citizens. That's a way of supporting metropolitan economic engines. So it's not that the federal government is irrelevant or unimportant. It's just that it's not in a position to be creative and innovative when it comes to rebuilding the American economy and getting us away from the economy that got us into the recession that was built on consumption and debt and moving us into a new kind of economy that's more oriented towards production, exports, and opportunity. That's a big thing, and that's something that metros are taking the lead on.
And are metros taking the lead on – I mean, it seems like we've been talking mostly about economic development, but from that economic development, are they taking the lead on big sort of social issues around affordable housing, around global warming? I mean, from this sort of economic engine idea, do solutions to all these other big problems flow out of that?
Absolutely. If you look at what Houston is doing, for example, around integrating immigrants into society, Houston is one of the most diverse metropolitan areas in the country. And there's a network of settlement houses in Houston called Neighborhood Centers, Inc. They've been around for about 100 years, and they've adapted themselves to meet the needs of Houston's new immigrants, which are not just in the city of Houston. They're also in the surrounding suburbs. And they're helping people who come to Houston because they want to work. They want to contribute. They're helping them find their spot on the economic ladder and climb that economic ladder. You know, we'd like to say that the United States as a whole, the federal government, has an immigration policy, but metros need an immigrant policy because they're the people who deal with immigrants who are actually living, working, putting their kids in schools, and again, trying to make a contribution. That's a big thing. We also see cities and metropolitan areas taking the lead on climate change, on doing things to reduce their carbon emission. Former Mayor Villaraigosa in Los Angeles made some great strides at the Port of Los Angeles in decreasing carbon emissions from the large ships that come there. He changed the way that ships use power when they're in port. That resulted in a huge number of carbon emissions. Cities and metros are taking the lead on these issues, again, because it's not coming from the federal government, and they know that they can't wait.
Let's take a couple of calls. We're talking to Jennifer Bradley, along with Bruce Katz. She is the co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. Let's go to Pete, who's calling from Roxbury. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would just like to say, Jennifer, I had heard you on another program, and I'm very interested in what you're saying, and For the most part, I guess I support everything that you're proposing here. But I guess I'm curious about if you're selling short, like what the, I guess some of the advances that you would have because of a large and stable federal government, if you take, you know, Portland and their various, you know, initiatives for innovation, you know, where they'd be if another city, let's say up the Columbia River from them, decided to, you know, have a big microchip plant or something open up that would, you know, kind of put their green initiatives in jeopardy, you know, without something like a strong EPA or even, you know, what the role of the government is in, you know, a stable coastline and that kind of stuff. Anyway, I guess I'm just curious your response on that. Like, what is the role, or do you think you're selling short, like, the role of just taking for granted the stability of the fact that we already have this, you know, federal system in place?
Pete, good question. Jennifer?
That is a great question. A lot of times when people hear us talk about the power and potential of metropolitan areas, they say, oh, so you hate the federal government, or you want to shut down the federal government. And that's not what we're talking about. The federal government does have a very important role to play, as I said, in securing a safety net, in enforcing civil rights laws, and in making sure that the conditions of competition between our metropolitan areas and states are fair, so that a one state or community can't just export all of its pollution downriver. So we do need the federal government to continue to do those kinds of regulatory and enforcement actions that keep a level playing field. The issue is the federal government is probably not going to be able to make great strides in innovation, in economic development, in economic growth that we might be accustomed to looking to the feds to do. There's not the political will right now. And further on down the road, there's not going to be the capacity in the budget, in the discretionary part of the budget probably, for a lot of new inventions and new interventions. So the federal government needs to kind of hold the line on what it's doing and think about the ways that its existing programs and policies can better support metropolitan areas. And I'll give you an example. When Los Angeles wanted to build out its transit system, voters decided in 2008, right at the, you know, the really worst part of the recession, to tax themselves to build out this transit system. Former Mayor Villaraigosa said, you know, I've got the money to build this transit system out in 30 years, but if I compress that into 10 years, I can put more people to work more quickly. He went to the federal government to get a loan to help him work out the dollars on the project. The federal program that he was trying to use wasn't right. It was too small, and it didn't reflect the way that transit development really happens, which is that some money has to pay for rails and stations and development around stations. So he created a coalition of mayors, business, labor leaders from across the country, and they went back to the federal government and they said, you know, you need to change this program so that it works for us on the ground, Democrats and Republicans from, you know, small places and big places that are trying to change the way transportation is built and put people back to work. And the federal government responded. So that's the kind of dynamic that we need to see, is that metropolitan areas get together and they go to the federal government and they say, what you're doing isn't working well for us. Change it so that you can support us, because we need to be the ones who are driving this agenda. It can't match what folks in Washington think needs to happen. It has to match what people on the ground know needs to happen.
Jennifer, let me ask you, you know, to get back to Boston, which is in the process of electing a new mayor, yet the mayor's going to have a huge amount of influence on the entire region for around issues that you've been talking about. I'm wondering if you think we should be rethinking, in a way, if this whole metropolitan revolution suggests that we rethink a way to better organize a political system that represents the interests of these larger areas.
I think that mayors' jobs in the conditions of the metropolitan revolution, which I think are happening, you know, not just in the United States, but all around the country, people are realizing that metropolitan areas are really taking the lead. That makes the job of a mayor so much more complicated and even daunting, because mayors not only have to deal with safety in schools and trash and tree repairs and sidewalks, they have to deal with being able to network within the larger metropolitan area. They have to deal with being able to network with mayors across the country so that they can all go to Washington and try and make change. And they have to be able to represent their city or community on the global stage. So being a mayor is a really rich and complicated job now. There's a lot more than just being a good manager of local services. And the way that mayors are able to deliver this, we see this in Denver, in New York, in a lot of the other places that we talk about in our book, is they work through networks. They realize that not all of the wisdom about the economy or transportation or the environment or working across boundaries is confined to City Hall. So when Mayor Bloomberg tried to diversify the economy of New York City after the market meltdown in 2008, he and his economic development team went to 300 leaders of companies, small, medium, and large. They went to 24 community groups, and they went to dozens of university leaders and said, what's holding the New York economy back? What do you need here that we don't have? And the answer came back to them, we need more tech talent. We need more graduate-level engineers and applied scientists. So the city responded by creating a competition for three new applied sciences graduate schools. The city's investment in those schools was about $130 million for infrastructure improvements. They're getting about $2 billion in immediate investment, and over 30 years, they're going to see about $33 billion in economic activity, about 1,000 new companies created, and tens of thousands of new jobs. So that's how a mayor has to operate now, through these big networks, because it's a big job. It's bigger than it's ever been.
I don't know how closely you're following the Boston mayor race up here, but you write about Boston in the book, as we've mentioned. You know, as you think about sort of the challenge facing Boston's next mayor, what do you put on top of that list?
I think the challenge facing Boston's next mayor is to figure out how to maintain Boston's great innovation energy, to build on this idea of innovation districts, to figure out how Boston can create an amazing entrepreneurial ecosystem, again, that connects entrepreneurs and inventors and capitalists, and figure out how to get people from all across the region into this ecosystem of growth and development. And that means reaching out and figuring out how to get people in left-behind neighborhoods, how to reach into the schools and bring kids in schools into an entrepreneurial ecosystem, whether that's connecting them with manufacturing and manufacturing qualifications, bringing the innovation districts and their power and invention into schools, helping with STEM education. I think that is a particular challenge for the mayor.
It's a big, big challenge. And it's interesting, you know, we were just talking to mayoral candidate talking about rubber sidewalks and the problem with roots, pushing up paving stones on the sidewalk. So it's quite a job that goes from that to developing innovation districts to thinking about entrepreneurial ecosystems. What a job. What a challenge.
Yeah. But it's a great time to be a mayor in the United States. You know, if you look at Rahm Emanuel, who's now the mayor of Chicago, I think his career trajectory kind of exemplifies the metropolitan revolution, right? He worked at the White House. He was chief of staff. He was a member of he'd been a member of Congress before that. He was operating at the highest levels of federal power. And he said, this is not what I want to continue doing. I want to come to Chicago. He now calls being the mayor of Chicago the best job he's had in public life.
All right. That's Jennifer Bradley, along with Bruce Katz. She's the co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. Jennifer Bradley, thank you so much today. It's great to have you.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, the music of the Wood Brothers. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.